Okay, so today we are going to be studying in the fourth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 3, talks between Lord Shiva and Sati. So text number 12. Pashya prayantir abhavanya yosito. Pasha prayantir bhavanya yosito. Pyalankrita kanta sakha varutasa. Yasam vrajad bi siti kanta manditam. Nabo vimanai kalakhamsa pandubi. Pasha prayantir abhavanya yoshito. Pyalankrita kanta sakavarutasa. Yasam vrajabi siti kanta manditam. Namo vimanai kalahamsa panduvi. Anybody want to chant? Pasha prayanti abhavanya yoshito. Pyalankita
yasam rajad yisati kanta manditam.
Yasam rajad yisati kanta manditam. Namo vimanai kalahamsa panduvi. And the ladies want to chant? Pasya jasi payanti going abhava, O never born, anya yoshita, other women, api certainly, alankrita, ornamented, kanta sakha, with their husbands and friends, rutasa, in large numbers, yasam of them, rajabi flying, siti kanta, O blue-throated one, mandita, decorated, nava, the sky, vimanai, with airplanes, kalahamsa, swans, pandubi, white. Translation, O never-born, O blue-throated one, not only my relatives, but also other women, dressed in nice clothes and decorated with ornaments, are going there with their husbands and friends. Just see how their flocks of white airplanes have made the entire sky very beautiful. Nimai Pandit, do you want to read the purport?
Here, Lord Shiva is addressed as Abhava, which means one who is never born. Although generally he is known as Bhava, one who is born. Rudra, Lord Shiva, is actually born from between the eyes of Brahma, who is called Swayambhu, because he is not born of any human being or material creature, but is born directly from the lotus flower which grows from the abdomen of Vishnu. When Lord Shiva is addressed here as Abhava, this may be taken to mean one who has never felt material miseries. Sati wanted to impress upon her husband that even those who were not related to her father were also going, to say nothing of herself, who was intimately related with him.
Lord Shiva drank an ocean of poison and kept it in his throat, not swallowing it or allowing it to go down into his stomach, and thus his throat became blue. Since then he has been known as Nilakanta, or blue-throated. The reason that Lord Shiva drank an ocean of poison was for others' benefit. I think it went too far. Fourth line? Oh, and now since his wife was personally requesting him to go to her father's house, even if he did not wish to give her that permission, he should do so out of his great kindness.
Okay. I think there was a sentence missed here. When the ocean was churned by the demigods and demons, the churning first produced poison. So because the poisonous ocean might have affected others who were not so advanced, Lord Shiva drank all the ocean water. In other words, he could drink such a great quantity, such a great amount of poison for others' benefit. And now, since his wife was personally requesting him to go to her father's house, even if he did not wish to give that permission, he should do so out of his great kindness. So this is conversation between Sati and Lord Shiva concerning the sacrifice. I'm not sure, but we were supposed to review from the beginning of the fourth canto. And so in the fourth canto, it begins with a description of a dynasty of kings, and then there's a description of an initial sacrifice, where Lord Shiva is present, actually, at that sacrifice. Daksha makes an entrance into the sacrificial arena. At that time, he notices that although he's greeted by everybody, Lord Shiva doesn't greet him. He's sitting in meditation, and he doesn't get up to greet him. And who is Daksha in relation to Lord Shiva? He's his father-in-law. Okay, so if your father-in-law comes in, you know, it's you should respect him. You know, you should get up and, you know, say something. And so Lord Shiva didn't. And so therefore Daksha was upset, and he began criticizing him, specifically pointing out that he was superior to Daksha because of this relationship of him having married his daughter. And so that caused a lot of problems. A lot of family difficulties resulted. But then somehow or another, and I must admit that I didn't review those first chapters so carefully, but there was another sacrifice, and that's the one described here. This is the one that was called by Daksha himself. And he specifically did not invite Lord Shiva to come, because of the last sacrifice and the enmity he was feeling from that time. So he didn't ask Lord Shiva to come, but here we find that Sati, who is his daughter, She wasn't invited either, from what I understand. But she sees, as we read in the verse today, all her relatives and even others. It says here, not only my relatives, but also other women with their husbands and friends. And so she was expressing that, well, this is an open sacrifice. It seems so many people are going. It's not just a family thing, a closed family sacrifice, but others are going as well. So therefore, we should go. And if not we, but at least you should allow me to go. My father's holding this sacrifice. And so we have this verse today, which has some very interesting arguments for attending the sacrifice of Daksha. On the way here, driving here this morning, I passed a church. I think it's the Lighthouse Baptist Church, which is right on the 441 going towards Alachua. And they had a sign out on their board. I guess it's for the sermon that they give every week. And that sign said, what did it say? It said, right and kind. It said, oh my God, I can't believe I forgot what it said. It said something about how giving up, learning to express kindness as opposed to being right. Yeah, expressing kindness is better than being right. So we had a little conversation about this, my wife and I, because it's interesting because that same dynamic is kind of playing out here. Sati is requesting Lord Shiva to be kind, but he's right, isn't he? I mean, after all, he wasn't invited. He was insulted. And so is it going to be better for him to be right about not going or to be kind to let Sati go? And so what I'd like to do is have my wife explain a little bit about this, because it's an argument between husband and wife. So last week we had the verse that described how Kardama Muni and Devahuti were ideally situated for each other, you know, so that was kind of the lovey-dovey thing, and this is the kind of husband and wife fighting thing this week. So she has had some interesting insight on this from different things she's heard, listening to His Holiness Radha Govinda Maharaj speak about the subject matter of Daksha Yajna. And so I asked her to describe a little bit about the back and forth between husband and wife that's going on. It's sort of the background to this verse.
Okay, I haven't read the fourth canto recently, but I do kind of remember hearing Radha Govinda Maharaj talking about this whole pastime. And usually Radha Govinda Maharaj, he basically relates the commentaries by the acharyas. So in this particular verse, he's talking that how Lord Shiva, you know, after Parvati and Lord Shiva, they have a discussion, and then Lord Shiva says, well, it's really not right to go. And she's saying, well, but I want to go, and we should go, and there's, in family, you don't need an invitation. We're family, so family can go anytime to the family's house, so we don't need any invitation. And he says, you know, no, we shouldn't go because he didn't invite us. So after a certain time, Lord Shiva just stays silent. And then Mother Parvati, she still wants to go, but she wants the permission. And so it describes in the Bhagavatam, as far as I remember, that she is on the mental platform. So Maharaj describes that how she walks out of the house thinking, okay, I'm going to go. She gets very upset. She walks out and stomps out of the house to go to the sacrifice. And then she thinks, oh, but Lord Shiva hasn't given me permission and I shouldn't go. So then she walks back into the house. And she goes back and forth, like thinking, I shouldn't. And then eventually, she decides to go. And there, Lord Shiva, it's interesting how he acts. And that's where the discussion was. My husband was saying whether he was he being kind. I said, yes, he was being kind, because when actually Parvati does decide to go, Lord Shiva, he sends, for her protection, he sends all the Ganas to protect her, because she was going to go on her own. She never went anywhere on her own, but he sent all the his military people, so to speak, to protect her. And so that's where he's being kind to her. Although he's being right, he's actually being kind. He's right by that she shouldn't go, but he's being kind because he gives protection for her. But I don't know if the Acharya's comment or what, but Radhagovinda Maharaj says that Lord Shiva is thinking, well, Lord Shiva already knew that she was going to go there and her father was going to insult her and probably she'll commit suicide. And so he thought better to let her go, because if he really forcefully keeps her here and she commits suicide here, then he's going to be blamed. Then look at that, you know, I knew that son-in-law was so bad, you know, and look at that, and then it's going to be all over. The Lord Shiva killed his wife, you know. He said, so better if she goes to her father's house, and she can do whatever she wants to do there, you know. And then it's his fault and not my fault, you know. So I don't know if Mar says it or the Acharya's comments like that, but that's what was going on.
Okay, so is it better to be kind, or is it better to be right? Does anybody have any? Not just in this circumstance, but this is a lesson we're learning from Bhagavatam, and it's applicable in all kinds of situations in our own lives. It's interesting that, again, last week we were talking about essentially family affairs, relationship with man and woman, and here again, the same theme is there, family affairs. And so Bhagavatam deals with all aspects of our lives, but these same basic questions keep coming up again and again and again. So, is it better to be right, or is it better to be kind? We are a preaching movement. You mentioned that you're going to be doing some strategic planning and things like that, and trying to decide what kind of direction, what kind of preaching you want to do here, what kind of outreach, how do you want it to be structured. So that could be right, or it could be kind. So what is it? Is it better to be right, or is it better to be kind? Does anybody have anything? Yes.
Better to be kind in knowledge rather than kind in ignorance. So it's a combination of both.
Meaning?
Sometimes we may imagine that we are being kind, but we are also being ignorant and we are doing harm to other person by being kind. Like somebody is having disease and he wants fried pakoras, so we should not give him out of kindness. Mm-hmm. But we can be kind so that they are not broken. Some combination.
My Guru Maharaj Shachinandana Maharaj, he was also making point of, I guess, parallel point that the relationship is more important than being right. And I guess the Nanda Kumara Prabhu said, what he said is also correct and right. But at the same time, many times it doesn't really, you can give your conversation partner his point, and even though he may be not perfectly right, but an awful time we kind of, the reason why we want to say that it's right is because of our ego. But then let that ego go and then just, you know, let him or her win, and because relationship is more important. So
very good, good. And anybody else that has some things? Okay. Nothing on this side yet, huh? Okay.
I was thinking Arjuna was being kind on the battlefield, but Krishna told him to fight fight for the right cause.
Okay, so right in that sense wasn't necessarily meant killing people, right? Okay, follow the same.
Srila Prabhupada, the way that he would act was according to the individual circumstances or the individual person that he was dealing with. Sometimes he would act in a particular way to one person, and then he'd act a particular way to a different person, which was almost like completely different. So it seems to me that according to the time and the place, the circumstance and the person, every situation and every individual has to be, you know, treated in a particular way, according whatever was best for that situation.
Individuality. I think that's a good point, because we are individuals. We're individuals eternally, and so how Krishna reciprocates with us and how we reciprocate with him is going to be different, right? Yes.
Well, according to my understanding, one should be right in the first place, and then fill the gap by being kind.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Kalakanta likes that, so we're going to ask him to explain why he likes that.
Hey, this is another false argument from the Lighthouse Baptist Church. Because these two things are not mutually exclusive. Maybe the way they express it, it is better to express kindness than to be right. So the point is, you can be right and be kind at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as Krishna Sharanam Prabhu was saying, then if the other person is not accepting the rightness of your position, then you may defer. And then later that person may come to recognize, well, actually you were right, but you were also kind to me. Mm-hmm. So the point is, you can rarely go wrong by being kind. Mm-hmm. And it is more important to continually express kindness than to become rude out of righteousness.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
I just want to mention Kalakanta Prabhu, what he was saying. You can see that in this pastime, Lord Shiva was right and he was kind. So both things were there in this particular pastime.
Okay. What is your name, Prabhu?
Damodar.
Damodar.
Thank you, Shesha Prabhu. I think this is in the Bhagavad Gita in the 18th chapter where Krishna talks about speech in the mode of goodness. Satyam Priyahitam. So he says you should speak the truth, but in a way that's pleasing and also beneficial for the person who you're talking to.
Okay. Truth is spoken pleasingly and it's beneficial to the person. Okay. Yes. I think he turned it off.
In this pastime, Shiva, when she was asking Shiva to be kind to her and let her go, is because Shiva was so kind to all the living entities by drinking the poison. That's why she was saying, you know, be kind to me. But actually, Shiva, in a way, he stressed on being right because he told her not to go. Sati decided to go on her own. And then after, when she got there, I think she realized that Shiva was right. Mm-hmm. So more, I mean, he was kind because he's, like you said, Prabhu, he spoke pleasing words. You know, he kind of gave her, his opinion that we should not go. But he didn't tell her not to go. And then as far as all his military, all his followers, they actually knew what Shiva wanted before Shiva asked, because they saw Sati leaving and they immediately knew that Shiva would want them to go because she was going alone and she never went anywhere alone. Mm-hmm. So they kind of just, you know, did what the spiritual master wanted before he even asked.
So there may be greater forces at work in a situation, and our rightness or wrongness, we may not see the whole picture of everything. And there may be people, as you said, that even if we're acting in a wrong way, that others sort of take up the slack for us and help us. We find that in our preaching, don't we? Sometimes if I'm like hammering on somebody, then someone will come up to me and, you know, like make an intervention, you know, to make it smooth it over. And that's something that should be accepted too. Not that, oh, you know, don't tell me, you know. We can always take a good advice, and I think that's something that's always right. Yes.
I was going to comment that, considering you're a lawyer, what's your position?
What's my position?
And that's, it's like,
who's paying? That's
very nice answer.
Okay. Okay, I want to follow something on what Derek was saying, and because this comes up in the context of others, right? It comes up in the context of others. He correctly points out that she's calling him Nilakanta and using this specific name to indicate his kindness and his willingness to sacrifice for others. And this is also a theme that that I've happened to see on another billboard. Yesterday I was going to Orlando, and on the Florida Turnpike towards Orlando, there's a billboard for the United States Marine Corps. And maybe you've seen it in different places, and it has a big letters, sacrifice. And it has a Marine saluting, and it's the other line on there says that recognizing something greater than themselves. Recognizing something greater than themselves. In other words, their appeal, and this is an appeal to get people to join the Marine Corps after all, is that you should sacrifice recognize that by doing that, you're sort of surrendering or submitting yourself to something that's greater than you as an individual. There's something greater than us as individuals, and we should sacrifice for them. And so that's a theme that we find a lot in Srimad Bhagavatam. We find it in the case of Lord Shiva right here, don't we? He drank that poison for the benefit of others. So all the other living entities in the universe would be saved from the great danger that poison presented. But why is this idea of sacrifice something that's so attractive? I mean, that is an attractive feature of Lord Shiva, isn't it? I mean, that he's Nilakanta, that he saved us like that. So we naturally feel, oh, that's very nice. Why do you think that even in a material thing like the United States Marine Corps, they can appeal to this sentiment in the living entity? Why is it something that's attractive? Yes?
Because it appeals to the hankering for fame and prestige.
That's materially why it may be there. But, I mean, in a more essential way. Well, in a more essential way.
We are subordinate to Lord Krishna, and we are part and parcel of Him. So that's natural position, so that's why.
Right, right. Anyone else have any other thing?
I think it's kind of like how we think we never die. Our soul is eternal. So similarly, our soul is naturally a servant or meant to sacrifice for Krishna. And so we naturally have that propensity. But if it's not properly directed towards Krishna, it's otherwise directed towards the military.
Right. I think I like both of these answers, because the essence is that we are meant to be the servant of Krishna. We are meant to sacrifice. That's our very existence. You know, in the Bhagavatam, there are three subject matters. We have Sambandhagyan and Abhideya and Payojana. So part of the Sambandha Gyan that's given, even in Bhagavad Gita, what to speak of in the Srimad Bhagavatam, is understanding the relationship between the living entity and the Supreme Lord. And when we get to understanding the nature of the living entity, we see that that nature is very much a selfless kind of existence, a sacrificing kind of existence. Prabhupada gives different ways to understand it. He says in one purport in the Bhagavad Gita, the relationship can be understood as the teacher and the taught, or the master and the servant. And last week, you remember, I was talking about this concept of Guru Prasad being the secondary enjoyer. And so that is the real nature of the living entity, is this to sacrifice, to live and to exist for others. And so naturally, we find that in great personalities, Vaishnavam Yatha Shambhu, the greatest Vaishnava, that he is willing to sacrifice for others, for the benefit of others. Where else do we find that in this Krishna consciousness movement in the Vaishnava literature, in the Vedic tradition, in the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition. Can anybody else give us some examples where we find this idea of sacrifice being played out? All of us see.
Best example is Srila Prabhupada, that he was living in the most ideal environment in Vrindavan, in Radhadamodar temple, very wonderful, purely transcendental, but he was thinking about all of the poor, suffering, conditioned souls that had no knowledge of Krishna consciousness. So he was willing to sacrifice his comfortable, ecstatic life in Vrindavan for the sake of giving Krishna consciousness to those who didn't have it.
Yes, Srila Prabhupada's life is exemplary. And there's another instance in Srila Prabhupada's life that really highlights this as well. Can anybody think of anything in Prabhupada's life? What was he instructed by Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, the last instruction that he gave to him by letter? Well, go ahead. Say what you were going to say.
Well, he told him to take sannyas in a dream.
Sannyas in a dream. Yeah, let's get to sannyas in a minute, but something before that. He was told, wasn't he, in a letter that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati wrote him just a few weeks before his departure, that if you preach in English, it will do good for you and others. Others, your audience, like that. So he explained like that, that you do this sacrifice, preach in English as I've instructed you, and it'll be good for you and it'll be good for others as well. And so it's very much a part of the instruction of the guru to tells us to sacrifice. Any other examples? What about the life of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu? Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took sannyas. Why did he take sannyas? For the benefit of others, isn't it? He didn't. Sannyas in our line. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taking sannyas, and particularly from Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who reestablished the Vaishnava sannyas, it's not a sannyas that's meant for exclusion and renunciation and getting away from people, is it? Sannyas is particularly, especially as it's practiced in ISKCON, is meant to completely dedicate your service, completely free you of other obligations, so that you can dedicate 100% of your time to others, serving others by spreading Krishna consciousness. So this idea is prevalent there. Now, here in this circumstance, we find that Lord Shiva is not going to the sacrifice. He's advising his wife Sati not to go. And how does he maintain the same reputation then as working for the benefit of others if he's not going to participate? How does his withholding his wife from going, his own personal going, not violate this idea of doing good for others? Anybody else? Good. Finally, we get somebody over here. Okay.
I guess he keeps them from further offenses and creating more chaos in their own lives and lives of others. And also, he knows that that she will be offended by going there, so it's a protection for her.
Okay, good. By withholding, by not going, by not interacting with people, he's preventing them from creating offenses to them. And so in that way, he's also benefiting them, because offenses to the Vaishnava devotees of the Lord are very serious. Any other perspectives on how his withholding is? You wanted to say something? Same minute, same point. Okay. Anything else? Yes.
Well, this pastime alone is meant for everybody else to read, for all of us to read now. So by him not going, is giving you Well, and actually by Sati, Mother Sati going, it gives us an example of what we should and what we should not do for all of us today. So it's like a, you know, good path, and it's relevant. It goes on every day right now. You know, so it's a good instruction for all of us today.
I'm wondering if I've heard that one of the sacrifices we should make sometimes is to spend time with relatives, and something of the verse is that it's like an attractive thing she wanted to go to where her father was, and even if we might have non-devotee family or something we can go to just show that we care, it's not in the same situation that we're like, we stay at Kailash and stay at our house for, that we would go do that as our sacrifice. I was wondering about that perspective.
Okay, is that a question you're asking? Or? Clarify the question for me.
That we're not supposed to act like Lord Shiva and saying, oh no, I'm not going to go. You can go and commit suicide at your father's house, but I'm going to stay at home. And
Anybody have an answer for Garrison? We'll just leave it to her. She has an answer for everything. I think you have to turn it on.
But I think your question is that is Lord Shiva showing us an example by not going and letting her go ahead and commit suicide? Yeah. Well, I think, like you said, it's a different situations, but I don't think that he is... I think it seems like more what the class was about, in the sense of that he is showing more kindness by protecting her. In other words, he's letting her go, and yet he is protecting her, and that he's not forcing her not to go. I mean, I don't know. Is it clear what I'm saying? That the example is more that he's letting he's not forcefully keeping his wife. He's not keeping, you know, he's not beating her up or whatever. He's letting her go.
Let me see if I can, you know, get some better understanding. I think the question is about how do we relate to our families? How do we relate to our families, and do we associate with them? How do we associate with them? How do we protect our own Krishna consciousness? How do we give them Krishna consciousness?
We might have more of a tendency to say just like, oh no, we don't need to go do this. And the wife has more compassion. And she says, no, let's go visit them. Let's go see them. It's easier for boys to forget that and just throw that off.
Yeah, okay. So that's a fair question then. How do we relate with Krishna consciousness to our family? How do we be right or express kindness in relation to our own family members in terms of Krishna consciousness? I remember one time myself, I was traveling on a library party, and we came to New York. We were in New York City. And my family was in Albany, which is just up the river, maybe about a couple of hours up the river, drive up the highway. And so I asked, you know, my authority if I could go there and, you know, get some coat or something like that. It was winter time. Well, actually, that's how the authority responded, not necessarily so bluntly. He was trying to be a little kind, but he said, no, I don't think that's a good idea. Now, I had no intention of not coming back or something like that, blooping or something, but he restricted me from going. Well, was that right? Was that a right thing for the authority to tell me at that point? Paul was saying.
I think it's according to an individual thing, but I think in general, I think that's probably a good advice. I know when I was growing up, we were growing up together at the same time. That was the general consensus that we had heard from Prabhupada, was that to go back and associate with friendship or family and love, on in any way, it could be a dangerous thing. Even if we had all good intentions and even if we felt strong, still I think Prabhupada was protecting us. And I think that wasn't that the general consensus, not just in your situation but in my situation too. I don't remember practically anybody going back and seeing families or friends or loved ones or anything like that, for the simple reason that the contamination could very easily cause one to stray from Krishna consciousness. That was
okay.
The way I was
Okay. Well, brought. Yeah, I think that was a prevalent mood during the time. But the question is, and let's look back now, 30 years ago, and was it right? I mean, was it right that we did like that?
I think it was the general consensus. I'm not so positive myself that it was coming from Prabhupada directly. Because it ended up being pretty bad PR with our parents. And our parents could have benefited with a more favorable attitude towards Krishna consciousness if we had behaved more maturely.
Yeah, I think there was definitely some immaturity in how it was expressed. You know, however it came from Prabhupada, it didn't come from Prabhupada, but certainly there was some immaturity in how it was expressed.
I think also it's be good to distinguish, like, it might have a right concern, but not necessarily that that specific strategy that you won't go would be the right thing to do. In other words, it could be that, you know, the right thing to explain to you, you know, the importance of, you know, associating and how to just go and not associate or something like, I mean, you know, different other ways. So I think it's more like kind of in any situation, just kind of trying to figure out what's right and what's wrong is like really to see the end, like I say, end goal in mind, and like what are the really little steps that we are trying to restrict or not.
Okay, thank you. I think that's very good. I'm going to have Kalakant speak, but I do want to ask Chaitanya Chandra this question because he mentioned about the importance of the relationships. I want to hear what he has to say about that.
It depends on the maturity of the devotee and also the attitude of the family. So it's not etched in stone. I have no qualms about when our Indian-born students are going to go back for a function in India. I'm not worried about them, you know, becoming enamored with material energy. But I have seen young students here on occasion going back, Western-born students going back to visit families and then becoming overwhelmed by Maya because they really weren't strong enough in their conviction. And it's difficult. And there are families that are very friendly and appreciative or at least tolerant. And then there are families who are outright inimical. Like last week we were hearing about Madhava Prabhu's family trying to kidnap him from Krishna consciousness, forcing him to dress in a sari to escape from the deprogrammers. Mm. Can you imagine the sight of that?
No, I can't.
So if the parents are really trying to draw the person back, then a devotee may kindly say, I don't think you should go see them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's hear Chaitanya.
I think this is probably issue specifically related to like adult converts, those from non-South Asian background whose parents may not have very good understanding of what Krishna consciousness is about. And I wanted to share the example of my Guru Maharaj, Satchinandana Maharaj. Actually, his father attended, and he actually even asked Prabhupada question. And basically, he didn't quite understand what Krishna consciousness is. And basically, he was opposed. And then two of his sons, coming from good family, he felt was stolen by Prabhupada. So he was very angry. So because of that situation, my Guru Maharaj didn't see his family for like 20 or 25 years. But then after that period, it was clear to his parents that no matter what they say, that he wouldn't change. So when parents once accepted that Satchinandana Maharaj would be dedicated to Krishna consciousness, and only then he sort of started to going back, and now he goes to his family once a year for Christmas. So that's an example that Karakanta Prabhu said that, well, in the beginning, when we are very not strong, or when the parents are not accepting our choice, then maybe it's necessary for us to keep away. But once we ourselves become fixed, and then also once the parents sort of accept that your choice is your choice, then maybe we can go back and then sort of start developing new relationship.
Okay, thank you. I think there's one consideration about this topic that's important to add to our discussion, and that is that a lot of times, and in different countries, I think of Italy, for instance, how Krishna consciousness spread in Italy. Krishna consciousness spread in Italy in a different way than it did in the United States, because there, whole families joined. You got whole families joining. One of the children or the father or the mother became interested in Krishna consciousness, and they didn't have this idea of separating from the family as a necessity to protect themselves and their own tender Krishna consciousness, but rather they got all their family members into it, and then you had whole families joining. And so the movement there grew quite quickly on that kind of basis. And that's different than in America, where we kind of individually went, and also in India. A lot of times in India, they may expect that someone takes to a renounced life, becomes a sannyasi or brahmachari or something like that. But they don't expect a whole family to do that, you know. And even Prabhupada, he said, give me one of your sons, and the rest you can keep and engage like that. So both in India and in United States, or the Western Europe and America, not Western Europe because Italy's there, but say United States, you find this individuals coming. But in other cultures, like in Italy, whole families came. And so there, you know, the argument would be, well, you know, no, come and interact with your family, you know, and in that way increase the Vaishnava fold more exponentially. So that's again, individual circumstances. Yeah.
Just question, is it because of particular Italian culture that they're close?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think so. The families are close there, and if you start breaking them up, you're probably going to have more difficulty spreading Krishna consciousness than if you try to have everyone come together. And so I think that that was one of the factors there in Italy. Yes. You have to turn it on. You have to turn it on.
Can I just share one story that happened in India related to this topic? I think in Gujarat, if I'm not mistaken, there was a devotee who ran from his home, and he went to a few ISKCON temples, and his parents were chasing after him. And then finally he came to this temple of Mahavishnu Goswami Maharaj, and when he reached the temple, all the devotees were very excited to have such a fired up devotee. But when Maharaj saw him, he immediately called his parents, asked them to come to the temple, and he requested this devotee to go back with his parents and serve them first. And what happened was, after a few years, the parents came back to the temple, offered the devotee back to Maharaj, and they told, we know he'd be happy serving you. And then after another few years, the entire family became initiated devotees.
So that's another unique way. It gets back to Balabhasin's point about, and Kalakanta made the same point, these are individual circumstances. So as we take lessons from this, we should apply them and be ready to apply them to ourselves individually and not think that there's one size fits all. Damodar?
I think this is how the pastime goes, that Raghunath Das Goswami wanted to join the movement of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, but he was restricted. They wanted to allure him to material life. They didn't want him to become a renunciate, so they got him married to a very beautiful woman. But still, he was escaping. And they even had to get guards to keep him, but he had still escaped to see Lord Chaitanya. But I think, isn't it true that Lord Chaitanya advised him to stay and serve your parents until he approached Nityananda Prabhu?
Yes, he was advised to be patient, and that Krishna would show him the time and place when he can, you know, pursue his Krishna consciousness. But it's interesting you mentioned about serving your parents. The six Goswamis of Vrindavan, who knows how many of those Goswamis were specifically instructed to go and serve their parents until they left this world, and then only come to Vrindavan? Two of the six Goswamis were specifically instructed by Lord Chaitanya, go and serve your parents, but serve them because why? Because they're also Vaishnavas, right? He didn't say go and serve them in their, you know, degraded lifestyles, but go and serve them because they're Vaishnavas. And so, again, it's individual circumstances, how we deal with these family issues and how we determine whether we're right or whether we are kind.